Welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast. I'm John, Father John Deere, and today I'm speaking with my friend, Professor Dr. Melanie Harris. This is a project of www.beatitudecenter.org, where you can find many other podcasts and regular Zoom programs on the nonviolence of Jesus, practicing nonviolence, and working for a more just, more nonviolent world. So let's begin with a little prayer, as usual, and so I invite everyone, wherever you are, just to take a deep breath and just to relax and recenter yourself. And together, let's enter into the presence of the God of peace who loves you infinitely and personally and everyone everywhere. And let's welcome the risen nonviolent Jesus here with us. Just take a moment, ask for whatever grace you need to follow the nonviolent Jesus more faithfully and to do God's will. God of peace, thank you for all the blessings of life, love, and peace that you give us. Be with us now as we reflect together on your call to follow the nonviolent Jesus and work for a more nonviolent, more just world. Bless us, inspire us, disarm us, heal us, strengthen us, and send us out to do your will, to do our part to help end racism, poverty, and greed, injustice and warfare, nuclear weapons, and environmental destruction, that we might be your beatitude people, your holy peacemakers, and welcome your reign of universal love, nonviolence, and peace on earth. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, it's a great blessing to welcome Dr. Melanie Harris, professor of Black feminist and womanist theologies, jointly appointed with African American Studies at Wake Forest University in North Carolina. She also serves as the Director of Food, Health, and Ecological Well-Being at Wake Forest. A graduate of the Harvard Leadership Program, Melanie is the author of several great books, including Gifts of Virtue, Alice Walker, and Womanist Ethics, and the book I'll be talking about, Eco-Womanism, Earth-Honoring Faiths. She's a former broadcast journalist who worked as a news producer for ABC, CBS, and NBC affiliates. Dr. Harris earned her PhD and MA degrees from New York's Union Theological Seminary and her MDiv from Iliff School of Theology in Denver and a BA from Spelman College in Atlanta. Dr. Melanie Harris, welcome to the Nonviolent Jesus Podcast.
Wow, wonderful to be with you, John Deere. What an honor. I celebrate you and so grateful for the work of nonviolence and peace that you do and have written about for decades. So grateful to you for your path of peace.
Thanks, Melanie. A year ago, you did a great Zoom presentation for the Beatitude Center on your recent powerful Orbis book, Eco-Womanism, which is about women of color, ecology, and climate change. Wow. And well, first of all, let me invite listeners to, if they want to, they could go and check out that Zoom program at the Beatitude Center free YouTube channel. But I thought it would be great to have you on this podcast to share some of your great insights with everybody. And the book begins with your own story of your grandparents leaving the Jim Crow South and partnering with other Black families and leaders in the Great Migration North, and you all ended up in Colorado. So I thought before we get a little into the book, you could tell me a little of your story and how your journey led you to these studies and combining them together and connecting women, African Americans, ecology, theology, peace building, and interfaith religions.
Thank you so much. It is an invitation indeed. I think we heal each other through our own stories. And so I appreciate the invitation to share. I am indeed the descendant of those brave souls, my grandparents, who migrated from the Jim and Jane Crow South in Mississippi all the way to Colorado. They, with 30 other families, began the Black settlement, the first Black settlement there called Deerfield, Colorado. It's just outside of Fort Collins. And at that time, they were able to build together an entire community to be able to celebrate both harvest season, but also planting seasons for a few years. Of course, the dirt and the soil in Denver, Colorado, and Colorado is much different than the rich, fertile soil in the South. And so a part of their journey was really bringing the agricultural knowledge that they knew in the South all the way West. And we know that a lot of those wisdoms, a lot of the ways in which they connected with the earth are a part of why Black communities across the diaspora have actually been able to survive and thrive under really unfortunate and also difficult circumstances. The city and town, a township, kind of the settlement of Deerfield, Colorado, lasted just for a few years, actually. And eventually, many of those families had to migrate forward. My family decided to stay close in Denver, Colorado. And so my father was born there in Denver, Colorado, John A. Harris. He later became the first African-American to work for the city and county of Denver, Colorado. His father, Singleton Harris, worked for the Mint. And there were a lot of different realities that African-American and African-American families had to work through during that time, including racism. And so a part of my family weaving is not just this real deep touch point into the earth and into the gift of the wisdom, agricultural wisdom, women's wisdom, on how to create a space for families and communities to survive, but also these real realities of having to navigate, to name, and to also survive racism as they knew it.
And then how did this inspire you on your journey into these studies?
It's amazing.
You also had a media career.
Yeah, it is amazing. I think being the first, I saw that model both in my mother and also in my father. My mother migrated in some sense during that latter phase of the Great Migration from Mississippi, having been trained as an educator there, came on to Colorado eventually and began her life and career as a formal educator. She actually was able to receive a master's at the University of Wisconsin before coming to Colorado, but then also did a lot of deepening work in her education and in her studies there in Denver, Colorado. I really came up in this educator's preacher family.
Well, that explains everything.
A lot of that, the gift of faith, but also the music of Black people, the music of protest, the music of the movement, but also the music of jazz and the blues. And so that was a part of my upbringing. So I think what was so instructional in the way that I opened Eco-Womanism, the book, is to recognize that for my mom, the best way to honor the earth around us was to sing with earth in this very deep way of nurturing both the soul of the singer and also the soul of earth around her. So I write really powerfully about a great divine witness that we were able to see in May almost every year. My mother had a grove, a small grove of aspen trees that grew in the front of the yard. And there was a gorgeous rose, beautiful rose bush that grew up right alongside the aspens. So every time that the aspens would open up into spring with these beautiful green leaves, the pink from the rose bush danced alongside the very bright green of the aspen leaves. That sight was so empowering for me to recognize that the music that I knew in my own soul from African American spirituals, Black music and Black song, was being witnessed in the earth. For me, that became a very spiritual connection, being able to see the same faith tradition in nature, to be able to see the imprint of God's beauty in my own self, became really important in terms of me recognizing there's a connection here and an interconnection that, as my mother would teach me, every time we sing a song that reflects the gift and the power of the ancestors, we can see in earth the beauty of God reflecting that same divine power and divine love.
Thank you. That's so beautiful. So your journey takes you from Spelman to Union to Harvard, and you become a great teacher, and you write this new kind of groundbreaking book, Eco-Womanism, with the subtitle Earth Honoring Faiths. So, but I want you to tell us all about the book, but tell us too, so that everybody knows about, I think you're talking about something beyond feminist theology, which is womanist theology, and you're also connecting it with environmental theology, and that's an original connection there, and mainly for and from African-American communities. So what is womanist theology? And then tell us about the book.
Well, womanist is a term that was coined by Alice Walker, literary genius and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Color Purple. She wrote numerous books and extraordinary poetry.
You wrote a book about Alice Walker, right?
I did. My first book, Gifts of Virtue, is really about her particular work, particularly her nonfiction voice, and how it itself then back into the conversation and religion and the study of religion for the doing of justice work in the world. Alice Walker herself was a powerful activist and still is a powerful activist deeply embedded with the gift and really influenced, I think, a lot by Martin Luther King Jr., Fannie Lou Hamer, and Ella Baker, and so many others who were moving in the Southern Freedom Movement, as Dr. Vincent Harding will call it, as a way of trying to open up a democracy that we had not yet seen even at that point. And so a lot of her own social justice essays are what I pull from in order to investigate more of the ethical and moral framework of her thought, but also the thought of womanism. Womanist theology itself was actually came out of many different good, powerful seminary minds who were studying with Dr. James Cone at Union Theological Seminary. And they saw this term coined by Alice Walker, and they saw themselves in the term. What they were looking for is a term that would help them to come to voice themselves different from their white feminist colleagues and different from their Black male colleagues and others who they were in studying with. And so womanism became a voice, became a space, became a vehicle to be able to express Black women's realities and their theological perspectives, their naming of God. And so we call that womanist theology, that confessional generation of Jacqueline Grant and Katie Cannon and Dolores Williams. That confessional generation ends up then setting a path for a lot of women of color and particularly women of African descent studying theology, doing the work of ethics in the church, but also in the world. Womanist theology and ethics, biblical studies, all the hermeneutics that are connected to womanism ends up becoming a space where seminarians and certainly religious God talk takes place, but it's also very, very interdisciplinary. So the work of Layla Mapiron with the womanist idea, and she also edited a volume called The Womanist Reader, helps us to recognize that there were a lot of educators who were working at these intersections of race, class, and gender. There were a lot of theorists, including legal theorist Kimberly Crenshaw, who were working with these intersections and trying to name and express and give space for Black women's subjectivities and for Black women then to be able to write about the fact that they are often dealing with multiple forms of oppression, that means that their creativity, their way of thinking, their way of being, their way of practice is very different from a kind of normative Christian perspective, which might be considered a classical theological voice.
So tell me about then eco-womanism. Tell everyone about your book.
Well, this is so exciting because I think a part of a lot of the writings of Alice Walker, because Alice Walker, in many ways, experiences and expresses her spirituality through a variety of different religious traditions. There had been a bit of a debate among womanist theologians about whether or not her work and her thought could be used as a Christian theological perspective. And she herself, in many different essays, including many that she authored in 1995 in response to these questions, really helped people to recognize, oh, she's doing something different. She's actually widening the conversation about religion and about Christianity, because she recognizes that all African American and all women of African descent don't practice the same religious tradition. In fact, for generations, right, centuries, African American women and women of African descent have practiced multiple religious traditions. Alice Walker is one who really sets another path in for the study of religion and for the study of spirituality. One of those paths allows us to see this deep connection with Alice Walker's spirituality to earth-honoring faiths. She is always going to be looking for themes of the earth as sacred. She is always going to be lifting up opportunities for humans to recognize that they're not the center of the universe, but that all the beauty of the earth is a part of the kind of divine path that each of us can engage as we engage the work of freedom. This kind of freedom that Alice Walker represents in her own practice ended up happening and kind of expressing itself not only in her understanding of Jesus as a 7-year-old, which she writes in beautiful poetry, but also as someone who practiced meditation based on Buddhist practice, mm-hmm. someone who also understood her own understanding of herself, her tri-blood self as Cherokee, African-American, and also part white. So these particular openings of the complexity of what does it mean to be a Black woman ends up opening not only a space for Alice Walker to name herself and the deep commitment to the earth as sacred, but it also give a space for Black women to also recognize there's something more than womanism here. There is some kind of connection that is connected womanist identity and expression to earth. And so eco-womanism is the way of really focusing on the ecology and religion connection coming from a womanist tradition, coming from a womanist reality, but also signaling that the justice work that we do in gender justice, racial justice, sexual justice is also connected to environmental justice. And only upon coming into that interweaving, that intersectional analysis, then do we have a clearer picture of what the divine intends for justice for all of creation, all of earth. So the eco-womanism is both a theory and it's also a praxis. It's a way of being able to see and hope and move in this world in a just, truly just way.
Well, you know, listening to you, it gives me so much hope, because one of the things that have been happening in the midst of all the horrors of our world is that people, I would say, I wonder what you think about, just in the last few decades, are beginning to connect the dots. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, in movements, in different human groups, and you're talking about theologies, and this is really a beautiful sign, I think, of the Holy Spirit, that we're all beginning to, you know, connect, that this is all one, and you've given us a great gift here. So, Melanie, you have a new book out called Preaching Black Earth, which I haven't mm-hmm. seen. It's a collection of sermons, meditations, and interviews with leaders in the environmental justice movement, but it also has some of your poetry. Tell us about your new book and where people can get it and whatever you want us to know about it.
Yes, Preaching Black Earth is indeed a beautiful edited volume. It is published by Westminster John Knox Press. Really deeply grateful for Dr. Bridget Green for all of her amazing work there at Westminster. This book is really a collection of poems and conversations, interviews, but sermons that directly connect faith keepers of many different paths to the actual writing of the word and the way that we connect with earth. And so it presents itself as a model in many ways. The sermons themselves, written by many, many powerful eco-womanists, Sophia Bonancourt, Alonda Clay, Stacey Abrams, a powerful, powerful political voice, but also some kind of major Black liberation thinkers. We have John Kinney, Otis Moss, and many, many others who have been engaged in the movement Wow. of food justice, but also ecological justice. Wow. These voices come all together to be able to present this volume on Preaching Black Earth. You know, John, one of the most exciting things I see about the book is that it's just it's a beautiful story. Starting book. That is to say, if you're a reader and you're an audience member and you don't know exactly where to start, but you know that there is something important about faith and environment in your own soul, this is a great place to start because it outlines some particular pathways in to widening the conversation. So it doesn't just start with a kind of description of what a sermon is and an outline of a sermon, but it actually presents a sermon on environmental justice, particularly influenced by the Black preaching tradition, that allows you to weave your way into both faith, the understanding of Jesus, the understanding of the gospel, but also that understanding woven with this real passion for earth justice.
And you have poetry in it, some of your own. Would you share us one of your poems? Share with us?
I will indeed. This is exciting. This is the first volume that I've published some of my poetry in. So very excited for the opportunity to share. This poem is Breathing Earth by Melanie Harris. Breathing Earth, let us proclaim a new way of being. Interconnected, honoring, safe refuge, one to another, all sacred, all whole, all free.
Well, that was lovely and very helpful. I think you're going to have to read us another one. It was so beautiful.
That's so great. Well, Breathing Earth is a beautiful piece. It really does.
Really,
yeah, it's a
beautiful image. Yeah.
Very
much like Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, in the book, you'll actually see there quite a bit of influences here on eco-womanism and a part of the importance of eco-womanism, this interfaith reality, is a part of the method of eco-womanism as a theory. It's a seven-step method, which really begins, as we begin today, with honoring experience or honoring story. That is particularly important for people of color, in part because the way that many peoples of color come into the environmental movement is not the same as many white folks coming into the environmental movement. Peoples of color, at least in the United States, but I think globally, have a very different history. African Americans especially have a very different history as we are descendants of slaves. So that America, North America, is actually not the first place from which we came. Many, many African Americans still have the legacy of having been brought over. They are descendants of people who were brought over through the transatlantic slave trade. And so our continental home is Africa. In this sense, the trek, the journey of faith and religion and steadiness and strength is an important one that also marks not just one's understanding of oneself, but also one's understanding of the world and specifically the earth. Breathing Earth, then, is a piece, I think, that really does recognize that there's a beautiful weaving of eco-womanism that invites those of us who identify as Christian, but also invites those of us who find our way to Thich Nhat Hanh and find our way to many, many, many who have been writing for and in peace from different religious perspectives. The second poem is called Release by Melanie L. Harris. Old lungs release us from breathing stale air and spinning broken sermons. Help us come into a new song, awake to sorrow, embrace grief enough, so we may know joy. Let us love different. Find rest. Be fully present to the moment, assured that grace is more than abundance and accompanies struggle. Unfold with us hope that earth is breathing new.
Amen. Thank you so much, Melanie. So, as you know, I've been teaching the nonviolence of Gandhi and Dr. King and so many people as a way to understand Jesus and God, even what it means to be human in such an inhuman world. I wonder if you could reflect for a bit, in light of all of what you've been sharing with us, your own journey, the struggle of African Americans and women and the ecology and interfaith and peace building, your perspective on the nonviolent Jesus or gospel peacemaking. However you want to respond to that, where are you? What do you get from the gospels, if you will, these days?
That's so beautiful. Thank you so much, John Deere, for your work. Just incredible. I've been reading it since I can remember. And so I'm so grateful for the model of peace that you also walk in yourself and the way that you've led your ministry. One of the gifts, I think, of you is that there is a model in which we can all know Jesus and the nonviolence of Jesus as connected, but also interconnected interculturally, interracially, and more. For me, someone who was raised as a Christian, I'm ordained in the AMB Church, African Methodist Episcopal Church, and continue to serve in ministry in faith communities. One of the things that becomes really important for me in this particular historical moment is to tell the story of Jesus well and truthfully. In truth, Jesus was a nonviolent person and someone who deeply, deeply was committed to compassion even in every encounter. There are certain gospel accounts and stories of Jesus in which he himself was corrected. The Syrophoenician woman, for example, this encounter of this woman and Jesus having this dialogue presents the woman with a particular deep wisdom that Jesus recognized. Even as he was, in some sense, chastised to a moment of recognizing this woman is right. In that context, for a male leader to be speaking to, touching, even expressing a connection to a woman was radical. Those are the kinds of models of radical peace giving, peace building that we see in Jesus and that we can see and do today. For me as a Christian, but also one who's trained in constructive theology and certainly coming out of the work and the realm of Union Theological, trained by James Cone, Larry Rasmussen, Dolores Williams, Katie Cannon, and so many others, it is important to recognize that the gospel of Jesus Christ is a gospel of peace. There are ways in which the gospel is being treated or spoken or even taught in this time where colonialism is a part and embraced by Christianity, where hierarchical power dynamics are assumed in Christianity. And it's not to say that in the history of Christianity that hasn't happened, but the truth is Jesus was not one who stood for violence. He was not one who stood for hierarchy. He was not one who stood and modeled these kinds of forms of what we call logics of domination. For Jesus, peace building was about connection. It was about oneness. It was about relationship and the deep understanding of the spirit divine within, connected to the spirit divine in all beings. That kind of sacred understanding is not only experienced in the gospel of Jesus, but we know that this is also reflective of a variety of different indigenous religious traditions. And so for me, the nonviolent Jesus is deeply a beautiful reflection of a lot of indigenous, African indigenous, but also native indigenous peoples and cosmologies. This is where we have to be brave as Christians to recognize that even our Christianity can be transformed. Mm-hmm. It can be transformed and it can move more into peace. And sometimes that means laying aside our particular doctrines, our particular theological categories, and recognizing that the peace in the earth that the Black Elk spoke of, the yes. peace in the earth that Indigenous yes. grandmothers, is the same peace that we experience and can experience with the peace of Christ.
Melanie, that was really beautiful and so moving and inspiring. I want to talk with you all day, and now I'm going to be a real downer and say, okay, here we are today, our country moving full on into, I mean, it seems back into full on white supremacy, authoritarianism, fascism, I think dictatorship, it's the end of democracy, and permanent warfare, corporate greed for the 0.01% of the super billionaires, and therefore, you know, not just the war in Iran and Gaza and Congo and South Sudan and Ukraine and so many places, but actively pursuing nuclear destruction and total environmental destruction. And you bring this whole journey and a real intellectual pursuit of the nonviolent Jesus in light of women's stories, African-American stories, the earth story, and the politics of and the peacemaking of the various religions. So tell me about your thoughts and suggestions for a Christian response to what I just call insanity, this mad rush to death that we're all witnessing every day. And any suggestions or thoughts you might have, especially coming as a theologian who's looked at trying to connect all these different angles for our listeners to be renewed and yet to not to give up or to be overwhelmed or despairing, but to actively live out the vision of the gospel.
Thank you. It is a really important time to have a spiritual practice. Alice Walker will write throughout a lot of her work about the importance of having a spiritual practice and a spiritual community. And this is that time. It is the time for all of us to lean into the rituals that we know help us to connect to the divine within ourselves and beyond, and to know the rituals that do not help us. And sometimes that discernment process can open the door to exploring Christianity through another door. I think one of the surprises of my own spiritual journey has been to meet Jesus and the peace of Jesus through a practice of Buddhist meditation. And as someone who is trained as a constructive theologian, it was pretty important for me to have particular understandings of Christian practice, but it was equally important for me to be willing to let them go. Enough to be able to lean into the beauty and the rhythm of earth, the beauty and the flow of God and the divine within. By navigating and being able to find the divine within each of us, we are enabled, I believe, to see the divine in others. But that care and the nourishment of the self and the spirit becomes central to our ability to humanize each other, particularly in a divisive world. So in this time and space of war, in the time and space of white supremacist kind of rule, in the time and space, even in our interpersonal relationships, where we feel the world dragging us apart, it is central to be able to humanize, to be able to see the divine in others. Now, this is a very old wisdom. It comes from Fannie Lou Hamer in the Black tradition. It comes from other Black grandmothers, and this goes way back. But it does signal that loving thy enemy is a central part of becoming a mature spiritual being. Because, as Thich Nhat Hanh will teach us, there are no enemies. All of us are interwoven and interconnected in this time. And so Larry Rasmussen and many others who have helped me grow up as a spiritual being in this time will say, in this moment, in the midst of climate degradation, in the midst of environmental, in the midst of political, what we might call insanity, we have to come back to our own peace and the teachings and the truth that we will have to have buckets and buckets of forgiveness and compassion in this time. It is a moment and a reminder, I think, for self-reflection, but it is also a moment to recognize that we cannot be our full selves unless we are all together. Ubuntu is an African proverb which says, I am because we are.
Yeah.
So the understanding of that reality, that wisdom, becomes central in being able to even begin to navigate this time. I think the path of hope is real. Hope is still very, very important for us to nurture. And so I think my kind of pithy wisdom for listeners would be, find the spaces of hope for your spirit and nourish those spaces as much as possible. Learn as much as you can about the elements that are bringing hope out of those spaces, and then deepen. Deepen as much as possible. I believe we're living in a time where we will need to seed peace from the very time we wake up to the very moment we go to sleep, in part because all day long we are somewhere in the world experiencing war and violence. So the more peace we can breathe in, and the more peace we can be a part of, the more peace we can bring about, the better.
That's so beautiful and very helpful. Again, thank you. And I wish we could go talk for hours more, so we'll have to talk again someday. But is there anything else you'd like to say, or any word of encouragement to our listeners to keep going as we wrap up our time?
Yeah, thank you so much. It's a wonderful gift. I work at Wake Forest University, of course, and we've just had the gift of being able to have a gathering around liberation theology featuring the voice of Dr. Kelly Brown Douglas.
Oh, wow.
And a part of the hope-giving word that she gave was for us to recognize that this is a time of deep sorrow and grief, but it is also a time in which we have the creativity to be joy. And so I think that the word around this moment in time is to not just find hope, but try to create joy as much as possible. Alice Walker and others will talk about the importance of dancing, right? The importance of doing a kind of African drumbeat, the importance of vibration, and recognizing that some of these very simple rituals, such as prayer and color and beauty and painting and contemplative writing, some of these very simple rituals are things that we can and must weave into our everyday life. There is beauty in earth. And there is beauty in us. We simply have to breathe and live it out.
Well, thank you so much, Melanie Harris, for speaking with me today and your beautiful encouragement to us all. Thank you, friends, for listening to this episode of the Nonviolent Jesus podcast. You can hear more podcasts and find other upcoming Zoom programs at beatitudecenter.org. And please sign up to receive our free e-blast there, with news about upcoming podcast guests and Zoom programs. And you can help me by please telling all your friends and coworkers about this podcast to help spread the word about it. And just a little plug, I have a new book out, which I hope you all get, called Universal Love, Surrendering to the God of Peace. So may the God of Peace bless you all. Keep on following the nonviolent Jesus and seeding peace and creating joy and hope and working for a more just, more nonviolent country and world. See you next time.